Welcome back to You Can With AI. I'm Nathaniel Whittemore, your host and host of the AI Daily Brief. By now, basically every organization has figured out that getting people to use AI is not the same as getting people to be good at it. In one recent study that we'll discuss today, roughly 90% of employees were using AI, but only around 5% were using it in the way that actually creates value. Today's conversation is about what the difference between that 90% and that 5% looks like in practice, with two people who've studied it from completely different angles and landed in a very similar place. I'm joined by Kristen Swanson, head of AI fluency at Anthropic, where her team built the AI Fluency Index. Our other guest, Jamie Schmidt, is a professor of accounting and director of the C. Aubrey Smith Center for Auditing Education and Research at the University of Texas at Austin. Jamie led the team that did that enterprise study, 8 months of usage, 100,000 conversations, 1.4 million prompts. In this episode, we get into what the best users actually do differently, why AI training wears off within a month, and why human judgment matters even more in the agentic era. All right, Kristen, Jamie, welcome to You Can With AI. How's it going?
Great. Thanks for having us.
Yeah.
Yeah. Look, I'm very excited about this conversation. I've been excited about it for a while. I live in various dimensions in AI adoption and AI fluency land, but I think it has gotten even more pertinent and top of mind for lots of folks, let's say, since we started planning this to when we're actually recording it. So I'm very excited to have you both here. And what I want to do to start is just do a quick round of intros for the listeners to get a sense of who you are and what you work on, broadly speaking, in and around AI. And Jamie, maybe we'll start with you.
Sure. My name is Jamie Schmidt. I am a professor at the University of Texas. I have been doing research most of my career. And at Texas, we've kind of adopted AI at a pretty early phase. We had the year of AI here at the university, where we started a bunch of initiatives around it just to try to understand it, apply it, teach it to our students, et cetera. As part of that, we've done some studies around it, trying to understand adoption. And we'll talk about fluency later. But, you know, most of what I do is all around research and teaching my students to get really good at AI use.
Amazing.
So I guess other things, I am the director of the C. Aubrey Smith Center for Audit Education and Research, and we have done some AI stuff through the center and just educating students and also educating some practitioners on how to be better users of AI as well.
Wonderful. And Kristen.
Hi, everyone. It's so great to meet you. My name is Kristen Swanson, and I lead AI fluency efforts in education for Anthropic. And my main remit is to explore model-agnostic, product-agnostic collaboration behaviors that can help us all make the transition to AGI very safely. And so over the last few months, I've been learning as much as I can and trying to understand what it is we do as humans that make us good collaborators with AI.
Awesome. Well, so I think it's very clear just from the intros alone that your relationship with the set of questions we're going to be exploring today goes way beyond these anchor studies. But there is for each of you sort of a foundational piece that we've been thinking about in the context of this show that I want to introduce as a way to ground the listener. And Kristen, I actually want to start with you. If you could tell us about the AI Fluency Index, what it is, what the sort of methodology behind it was, and what you guys were trying to learn with it.
Yeah, so the AI Fluency Index was really born out of what we call our 4D AI fluency framework, which I believe that you use some pieces of at UT Austin, Jamie, is that right? Yeah. And so this was a framework that we created in partnership with a number of academics, notably Rick DeCon and Joe Feller, to help us understand what healthy collaboration with AI looks like. And so the 4Ds are delegation, description, discernment, and diligence. And what the index was our attempt to start observing them out in the wild across all of the Claude.ai users. And no surprise, what we found is that many of the same behaviors that make you really effective when collaborating with a human also make you effective when you are collaborating with AI, which we think is notable and, of course, worthy of more discovery. And we use this study to really consider and think about what humans do to collaborate well with AI. And no surprise, much of that is a reflection of what we already know about good collaboration. So there's a lot more to study here and a lot more to dig into, but exciting observations that I'm happy to share here today.
Awesome. And Jamie, you helped lead a study that had KPMG participating as well about sort of similar themes, sort of behaviors with regard to AI. I'd love to hear a little bit more about that.
Yeah, let me give you a little bit of background. So KPMG actually approached us. They had achieved about a 90% adoption like rate in their firm with people using AI, but they were really struggling with how do they define sophisticated use or effective use, you know, whatever words you want to label that. And how can they measure it internally to try to get their people at a better place than just being users, but being, you know, sophisticated, effective users. So they came to us and said, can you look at the prompting behavior of some of our people and really just kind of measure it for us and help us know how we can track it better internally and what we can do differently as an organization to kind of push our people along that, I think, AI journey. Because I think, you know, you get the tool, you learn the tool, you start to get better at the tool, and you really want to get the tool to a place where you can create value for an organization. So I think that's way what was driving them, but they asked us to partner with them. We looked at around 100,000 conversations, I think around 1.4 million prompts from a subset of their employees, about 2,500 of their employees. And what we really did, we kind of looked at it in three different ways. We looked at, okay, what is their use case? Are they doing something simple with it or something complex? What prompting strategies are they using? And those were kind of the two kind of baseline things first. And then we wrote, you know, 30 pages of a meta prompt and applied it to their employees' prompts and looked at different factors from how specific are they? Are they asking for a specific like type of content? Are they asking for structure? Are they uploading documents? Are they being clear? Are they challenging the output? All types of like different metrics of sophistication. And then like tried to identify, okay, we know 90% of them are using it, but which percentage are using it well? And interesting, we only found around 5% were really killing it, you know, doing what they needed to be doing to harness the technology at the level that I think the organization wanted them to. So next steps is really kind of working with them to figure out how can we get to the rest of the people up to that 5% level.
So let's talk about what that 5% includes. What are some of the types of behavioral hallmarks that are representative of someone who's killing it, to use your language?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think our findings really are very similar to Kristen's in some ways, but I think I can describe it in three ways. And some of them are going to be kind of surprising to you, I think. One thing we found is model switching. So when they're at a point where they can decide which AI model works best for a task, I think they're at a level of sophistication where they understand the tools and what they can do pretty well. There was also an interesting finding where they used more casual language. Now, keep in mind, it wasn't bad language. It was still specific language, but they had a comfort with the system that was a little bit different than our non-sophisticated users. And then I think the third piece is this like reasoning behavior, or they think of the AI as a reasoning partner. And let me kind of break that out for you, because I think there's a lot in that phrase, and I think I want to make it digestible to the audience. But really what that means is when they're using the AI, they're not just Google searching, right? They're using it and they're probing it. They're giving a very specific instructions where they're delegating something pretty big, but they're also giving boundaries to the machine. And maybe machine's not the right word, but to really harness, okay, I want this specific thing. I want it in this form. I want you to consider these factors. And then when they get the response, they don't stop there. They're pushing back and saying, okay, that was great, but did you consider this context? Or did I really was thinking about this and not what I told you the first time? Because if you think about it, a lot of this is very human. If you're a really good manager and you have a staff person working for you, you're going to be very clear with your instructions. You're going to tell them exactly what you want. And that staff person may deliver something back to you that you're like, okay, that wasn't exactly what I meant. I need something different. And then you have another conversation with the staff person and you say, okay, no, I kind of wanted this instead. And there's this back and forth iterative process with that human and getting them to give you what deliverable you wanted. I think it's very similar with AI, using them as a reasoning partner where you're going back and forth, you're kind of pushing the limits, you're challenging them and really being critical or using your own judgment when you look at the output so that you can get it into the form and the use that you really want to use it for.
And Kristen, how does some of that, those findings dovetail with what you're seeing with the Fluency Index?
Yeah, I think so many of these things are interrelated. So we talk quite a bit about augmentation, which it sounds like that is very similar to what you're finding in your study, Jamie. We also, and we see that people who use augmentation as their style of interaction tend to be more effective users overall. We also see quite a bit when it comes to iteration. So this idea that you don't take the first response and then you continue to go back and refine based on what you know as the expert to be a good response or an acceptable output. We actually think iteration is the gateway to sophisticated usage, because when people get more comfortable going back and forth and back and forth, they tend to end up with something at the end that they're much more comfortable using. There is one interesting piece too that I would imagine probably applies not just to our studies, but to many of the studies in this space, which is there's an interesting dynamic when you're working with AI that you have a tendency to evaluate what you can see and what you can observe. And as what you can see and what you observe looks more polished, you react to that artifact in kind. And I think one of the things that's been really interesting as we've started to talk to more and more people about sophisticated usage is we're seeing that those folks are not only just reacting to that artifact, but they're also digging in and questioning the model's reasoning, questioning how the model got to where it was, and doing that level of discernment, even if that is something that is not viewable in the pane itself. Very similar to what you were saying, Jamie, about choosing the right model and being able to understand how it works. Also being able to question how it's working, we've seen as another really key indicator of effective usage and sophisticated usage.
And this is a question for both of you guys. What was the window in which the conversations that you were analyzing was from? Kristen, first you, and then Jamie.
Yeah, so what we have published is just from a 1 week window. So this is a sample of about 10,000 conversations. We obviously look at this information in many different ways and lots of different things. The study that is out there that you can all take a look at on the internet features a 1 week window. I think, Jamie, yours was quite a bit longer, so I'd love to hear about that.
Yeah, for sure. So ours covered an 8 month time period, about 2,500 people. And then we looked at, it was really a back office group at KPMG, which might sound uninteresting, but is not, because it covers all types of people. So you imagine somebody in an accounting or finance role, somebody in a communications role, somebody in human talent management, somebody in HR. It is the engine that runs KPMG. So we have observations from a number of different types of people. And we actually looked at if there were differences in behavior across some of those types of people. And there was some surprising things. I mean, it was really interesting to see. And it was, I think the nice thing about it, too, is we had an 8 month period so we can look at changes over time a little bit more so than maybe Kristen's study could do. And we also could look at the effects of trainings that KPMG implemented over that time to see what effect those trainings had. I think one of the really interesting and cool things about this is like our study was longer term on an enterprise. Kristen was a week with a really broad, amazing sample. And we came to the same conclusion. And I think that's the, you know, as a researcher, that's what you want, right? You want triangulation, you want validation, you want replication in studies, because then you know you're getting to the truth, or you're getting to at least a nugget of the truth that can be implemented at an organization.
Yeah, and I certainly think that probably a lot of people, as they listen to some of these findings, will, if they feel competent and fluent with AI, are going to be nodding their head along, especially things like iterating alongside it, being able to test the boundaries, asking it for its logic behind things. Like very small examples, but if I'm ever discussing a title for a podcast, I usually will end up asking it to explain why it's suggesting this versus that, because there's a lot of assumptions that are involved in any given question that when you visualize them, they can help you help it do a better job. Jamie, or Kristen rather, I believe that the 7 day window that you were looking at in that particular study was in January. Jamie, when was the latest of these conversations? When did they take place?
Yeah, so ours is January 25 through August of 25. So it is a little bit earlier in KPMG's journey, but not too early. Like they had already, I really can't remember how long they'd had the systems in place, but we were jumping in the middle of that stream. So, I mean, it is a little bit dated now. I think they've made some progress since then, but not so far that it, I think it still speaks to at least some of the population.
So part of the reason that I'm asking about dates is, obviously, these are both very firmly in the reasoning model paradigm. But over the last 6 months, we've shifted, or at least added onto the sort of assisted type of use case, agentic use cases, which is in some ways a very different mode of collaboration. Now, I'm sure that both of you have spent time thinking about if and how these findings apply or are challenged by anything that's changing now. And maybe, Kristen, I'll go over to you. How do you guys think about if and how fluency changes as the mode shifts from Claude.ai to Claude Code or Claude Cowork?
Yeah, I think that's one of the most interesting things about the behaviors that you see in the index. I think many things that we have studied as researchers over the years, it's like you want the chart to go up and to the right. And I think with fluency, it's a little bit of a more nuanced conversation than that. I think the model that you're using can make a big difference in what your fingerprint of fluency looks like. I think the surface you're using can make a big difference. I think the harness that you're using can make a big difference. And as we start to see people interact with more agentic surfaces, we start to see them having different fingerprints of fluency. And I would say two of the very early behaviors that are starting to stand out to me are, one, setting a really clear goal or North Star and making sure that that is very clear to the agent that you're working with has started to rise to the top in a way on those surfaces that feels interesting and unique and requires, I think, a bit more study. The second one that I would say I've noticed is being able to think about the agentic experience not just as AI being you putting on your supersuit to make you better as an individual, but instead thinking about your team of agents and how you as a human interact with that team, as well as perhaps multiple humans interacting with multiple agents. So really going from single player to multiplayer. And that, I think, is going to have a lot of implications for what fluency looks like as well.
It feels like, though, on a broad level, it extends the analogy more than challenges it that Jamie was making before of the collaboration paradigm being akin to, or at least a good starting point being, working with an employee, right? That if these sort of anchor set of collaboration primitives were relevant in the assisted era, it sounds like they become even more so in the agentic era. But, you know, Jamie, I'd love your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I wanted to jump in here because I think this is even more important, the judgment piece. Like, I feel like we're at a judgment frontier. To be good at this, you've got to use your judgment, because the more sophisticated the output becomes, the more you need to leverage your domain expertise, like what you know to challenge it. And it just gets, the stakes are just higher when you go to an agentic world. So I know KPMG is like creating, and I think some adoption of orchestrator agents that, you know, are agents that direct other agents to do things. And those agents might do something. Well, if we're not challenging the output, you've got a system there that's being autonomous with very little control. And it could become a big problem. Even within our own study, like it was pretty rare for people in the system to set some acceptance criteria or boundaries and to really go and like ask it to check itself, to ask the system to say, okay, what are the weaknesses in your output? And like, what are the points I need to worry about? Very few people kind of like push back on the system. And if they're not doing that now, and we move into a world with agents, I think we could be in a world of hurt. I think there's a lot of opportunity. I think we'll get there. I'm not worried about it. But at some level, I think using your judgment, we need to do it really well. And this isn't a tech story. This is a human story. This is a, what do you know? Because you're using, you know, what you know in your brain. You're using AI, which can make your brain better. Because at any given time, like right now, my brain only can hold so many pieces of information. But I've got AI that can hold a lot. And I need to leverage both. I need to harness both of them. And the only way I can do that is by using my own expertise of what I really know well, which in my case is auditing. And then when I get an output, be able to challenge it and to go, does that make sense with my own view and what I know? And if not, I need to push back. And I think that's the important piece. So it is all about judgment. It's about human behavior. How do we monitor or lead our teams? Because this is just another teammate on the team. It just doesn't happen to have a body, but it's okay.
I think you're bringing up a really interesting point that I think sort of speaks to perhaps one of the many reasons why coding has been a place where agentic tools have been so vibrant and have taken off so quickly, because there's a strong culture of testing. And software developers are no stranger to developing a test to ensure the thing that's been created meets the criteria they set. And I have a hypothesis that we are about to experience a renaissance of testing of all kinds for all different kinds of knowledge work as these agentic systems become more independent and more capable.
We're seeing that at the firms. I just got back from a national office event where they were discussing different tools they want to deploy and testing them. And they were like, is 5,000 times of it working a good enough number? And they're trying to create those boundaries of when does this work? And when does this work at the level that I'm comfortable of deploying it to the entire workforce? And then what do I do if the context changes? Because then might not work as well. So I think those conversations are being held, at least at the accounting firms, on like how to manage that risk.
So both of you mentioned education, Kristen, as part of your remit and something you think about, and Jamie, as actually part of the study, being able to see where sort of moments of education or upskilling or skills intervention impacted or didn't impact the performance of folks with their AI fluency. As we move from an adoption mindset only to a fluency mindset, what do you think the role of education and upskilling is as organizations try to get their people prepared for this sort of?
Yeah, I mean, we see people come to us interested in education at a volume that I've never quite experienced before in my career. I think people's interest and appetite for learning a lot of this stuff is extremely high in this moment, and I think that's for lots of reasons. The one thing I've noticed as a through line is just this appetite and desire for agency. And so I think given everything that's happening in the world, I think all of the messaging that is out there on the internet, I think there is this concern that people won't have the agency to decide what, how, and where to use these tools. And so I think it's really critical to remind them that human judgment, human choice, human agency is a critical part of success when it comes to learning how to collaborate with AI. And so one of the things we really center with our 4D framework is this concept of delegation, that you need to understand what the models can do as well as what their limitations are, so you can make really strategic choices about which tasks are right for AI in your business and which tasks are right for humans in your business. And you, as humans and teams, make really strategic decisions about that. And so the more we've centered both agency and, honestly, the constant need to relearn because of the pace of change, those two pieces have, I think, been really important for learners that are coming. In some cases, they're excited. In other cases, perhaps they're fearful, to be able to take on board some of these new mindsets and new ideas and collaborate really effectively with AI.
I fully agree with what Kristen is saying. I think we're seeing the same stuff on our end. Even like in our study, we examined the effect of AI training on people's behavior. And it was super interesting. We found that in the month they took the training, that month, their behavior was significantly better, significantly as in statistically different. But it was short-lived. After that month, things started to trickle away or be dampened. And so I think one of the differences here, and I know the KPMG has been talking about this, is doing some more local, hands-on, team-based training where the teams are getting together, maybe within the same industry, and whatever their problems that they're trying to answer with AI, they're working together to be more targeted in the output and the strategies and learning from each other. Because I think where someone learns, and I'll just give you my own personal example, I 6 months ago was trying to get AI to do something and I couldn't get it to work. And I had my staff person who was an AI guru in my office. And I'm like, I can't get it to work. And I'm surprised. He's like, well, let me look at what you're doing. He's like, well, you're doing it all wrong. And he just comes over to my machine and he just goes tap, 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 tap. And then there it was. And I was like, great. You know, and I learned a lot from him, but it was this informal collaboration where he knew my goals. He's worked with me. He knew what we were trying to achieve. And he could sit down and show me. And that's transformed my abilities from that one conversation where there were a couple of things I wasn't quite getting right and I adjusted. And I think that's where we're going to see some ground up training instead of top level. Here's a training for all people. Let's look at this office or this industry and go, okay, here's what I need to achieve. And let's make some trainings that are applied so I can learn from it.
You bring up something that I think is really important. And it's this concept. Some people have called it the capability overhang. That what AI is capable of changes every single month as new models and new products are released. And so you may have tried something with AI and gotten a less than desirable output. If you don't ever go back and say, but can it do it now? You may be leaving a lot of value on the table, which is something, as I think about workforce development, that makes it so important to keep coming back and saying, I know we made a decision that we weren't going to do X and Y with this model because it wasn't quite good enough, but let's go back and push it and try again. And so this experimentation mindset and this continuous learning mindset, I think, is hard and it takes time and effort, but is well worth it.
you bring up a good point. It's persistence. I think that is the one kind of quality that we kind of let the data speak to us, but that kind of rose to the surface. And if something isn't working, maybe the model is going to get better over time. That's one part of it. But also, you're 50% of the problem. You're the human interacting with AI. And there could be something on your end that didn't enable it to harness its ability to get you the answer. So I think sometimes people will give up too quickly versus having that back and forth conversation to get where they need to. So again, I'm just going to go back to that, the human employee situation. Are you going to give up on the human? No, you're going to have a conversation like they're your colleague and get to the point where you achieve whatever organizational goal you're trying to achieve or work task. So I think that's just really important to push back, to keep trying and to think about what you could be doing differently as well, because there's always stuff we can do differently.
Absolutely.
Well, we're in this changing moment right now where because of agentic AI and different types of workloads coming online, there's more consideration around the cost of AI and token spend and token budgets than there has been in the past. It was fairly easy to be in an experimental mindset for quite some time. What's your best advice as organizations try to reconcile conflicting goals of increasing adoption, increasing fluency, increasing output, all while also keeping budgets in line? When you find yourself discussing with enterprises what they should do, what are some core pieces of advice that you would, or mental frameworks that you would give people?
I'd just say you want to get to sophistication quicker. You want your prompting or your whatever, your agents working at an efficient level and working well so that you're not having a lot of starts and stops. So I think that's just important. I think there are also all of the leaderships of the firms that I've talked to, the accounting firms, this is front and center of their minds where they're thinking about how do we deploy this in a cost-effective way? And so I think there's a lot of conversation around that. And I can't speak for what they're thinking about, but I think from the human perspective, it's getting your people at a really good use level so that when they're using it, they're creating value with it. Because if you can create value with it, then you can find a way to find the resources to support it. It's just when people are not using it, you're wasting money on something that's not creating any value. I think that's a big problem.
I think that those are some great points, Jamie. I would add to that, be very mindful of the incentives that you set. So if you set the incentive that usage is the goal, things will turn out very differently than if you set the incentive that creating value or innovation is the goal. And so I would be really thoughtful and mindful as a leadership team about what you communicate to employees as the goal for whatever that initiative may be. The other thing I would say, and maybe this is a little bit in the weeds, but one of the things that I have found to be absolutely transformative in terms of how I think about my own personal usage has been understanding the context window very deeply. And Claude Code is a tool where you can actually see the context window and how full the context window is and when to clear it out and when to start over. But if you are very mindful about what is inside that context window and what is actually being carried from conversation to conversation and how much you're actually asking the AI to read through every single time, you can actually get pretty similar outputs at a much more efficient cost. So I would say help people understand what the context window is and also provide them with tools, whether those are MCPs or skills or other things, to make it even easier for them to manage it well.
Awesome, guys. It's such rich and valuable information shared today. Really appreciate you spending some time here and can't wait to see how things have changed in a year from now.
Yeah, me too.
It'll be fun.
All right, guys. Thank you.